You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 26th of May, 2021. Christ has risen. I hope this Easter season is going well for everybody. Our life is one long Lent. This myth of the gas ransomware hack. My trip down south, thank God, was not affected by it. I'm not even seeing a huge spike in gas prices, but I do think it justifies gas prices being over $3 and yet the oil market being extremely depressed. If you remember, it wasn't that long ago, oil was in negative numbers, meaning that it costs more to store it than to sell it. And yet, gas prices only went down a very small amount and shot right back up again to roughly $3. That needed to be justified. And frankly, I haven't been paying much attention the last few days about that story. It's just one thing out of many. I did do something very uncharacteristic, though. I looked myself up on YouTube. I never look myself up on the internet, but for some bizarre reason, I decided to do it. And unfortunately, many of my, I've never done this myself, people make videos, and there's hundreds of them up there. And the numbers aren't very high because they get taken down pretty quickly. But the comments I receive have been extremely gratifying, and there's a lot of them. I don't know who this was, but someone wrote, I forget the lecture I was doing. Someone wrote, I was going to hit the like button here, but I think Dr. Johnson would think that I'm an idiot for doing so. So that made my day. Again, I apologize to many of you if I haven't gotten back to you. I get so much correspondence, especially over the last few years. I can't get to everyone. If I could afford a secretary, that would be a different story. But that hasn't been a possibility. Over the last, when I was on Facebook, I was getting hundreds of requests for information and even some serious spiritual questions, and I felt awful that I couldn't get to them all. And if any of you felt slighted by that, you have my apologies. That's not right. There's no excuse for it except the simple volume. You may have noticed that all of a sudden Fox News, and this is very typical of conservatives who are as much our enemies as anyone else, is now concerned with the anti-Semitism. This is now their big issue. The anti-Semitism over the current violence in Israel, which I'm not going to talk about today. I'll get to it. Maybe we'll do it tomorrow. I'm not sure. But there's been, protests and counter-protests in various capitals. And the Jewish Zionist side, there's been violence there. Fox News calls this an outrage, a hate crime in the true sense. And I'm noticing that just for those YouTube stories, Tucker Carlson and all these guys, they shut down the comment section. And just for those stories. Concerning these protests and counter-protests in Europe and America, their big issue now is anti-Semitism. Just for those stories, they have shut down the comment section. They were just condemning CNN and MSNBC for doing the exact same thing on their stories. Now Fox is doing it. And the reason that they're doing it is they know what they're going to get. And they know that this is really a function of cracking the whip. And they're ashamed of themselves. Now, I've gone after them in other stories, you know, but it doesn't sound right to attack them on that for a story that has nothing to do with it. But people know what I'm talking about. I just want to impress on you that conservatives are really a very low form of political life. And of course, I mean your typical, you know, modern suburban conservative today. Conservatism, of course, was an anti-capitalist, royalist, and agrarian movement and that came after the, with a reaction to the French Revolution and to even before then, the English Revolution. That is not what I'm referring to. The problem is that words are manipulated so badly and so twisted beyond their initial purpose that, you know, you can use the same word for everything. Conservatism is one of the worst in that sense. Even liberalism is. Your typical Fox News conservative, while occasionally saying an intelligent thing, they are what liberals were 30 years ago. In other words, 30 years from now, if there is 30 years from now, they're going to be talking about how important it is that we protect the rights of transsexuals and everything else. So, there's another important cause that Fox News is promoting. I'm seeing this in the so-called conservative press in Australia and a few other places, and that is war with China. There's even you've probably seen this already, the Chinese election meddling story that some of these human events types are putting out. And the worst one of all, I don't remember if this is Tucker Carlson, and he says so many good things, it's really hard to dislike the guy, but I do anyway. That Black Lives Matter somehow is a Chinese Communist Party movement financed by them in the U.S. But of course, these are the same people, as I've said many times before, that say the election was a fraud last year, and therefore we need to make sure we get the right people in office, go to the polls and vote. So how seriously can you take these people? Given this, I want to talk about the Chinese circumstance. I was the only one for a very long time. Now, as always, it's starting to catch on. God forbid someone cite me, but that China, of course, is a national socialist state. That is precisely what it is, in almost every regard. Of course, there are going to be differences because this is China. And they do have this Maoist background. But as I've said 1,000 times, Mao supporters were rounded up after his death in 1976. And the whole concept of the socialism of Chinese characteristics is a nationalization of the socialist idea and has everything to do with the economic explosion in that country since at least the era of Deng Xiaoping. The year I decided I was going to do this full-time was 1989. Now, some of you know it was the Romanian Revolution that, you know, pushed me forward. But something else happened that year, and that is the so-called Tiananmen Square massacre. This massacre never happened. Now you have major news organizations admitting it never happened. The notion of something so substantial, and this is before the internet, this is before cell phones, this is before all the messaging services. What else happened that never happened before we had the internet and WikiLeaks and everything else to give us the background information? Now, I knew back then, well, I shouldn't say that. I was too young to understand. It didn't take long, a few years later at the most, I knew that there was something wrong with these protesters. They were, would be considered American liberals. They were mostly upper class. It was a color revolution, in a sense. And you had conservative and liberals all both coming together, you know, condemning this militaristic response and everything else. But there were a lot of the aspects here that didn't make sense to me, but I didn't know enough. You know, again, we apparently didn't know anything before the web came around. And it's only been the last, I wrote an article on this that got published somewhere. I never remember where anything is. In 2016, I think. It was called Our Wish is to See Blood, The Myth of the 1989 Tiananmen Square Massacre. Now, in his book, Weiling Chua, it's called Tiananmen Square Massacre, The Power of Words Versus Silent Evidence. That came out in 2014, and the word massacre is put in quotes. Now, he lays out the case there that the massacre never happened. He is a dissident journalist. He works for the Australian News and Feature Services, and he also works for the International News Syndicate. But for the most part, he spends most of his time citing from Western news sources, admitting that there were no eyewitnesses to any shootings, despite the fact that there were journalists there for weeks and weeks and weeks. But when this started, no one decided to pick up a camera. I apologize, someone is mowing the lawn. But that's just going to have to be a cross we all have to bear. Not a single solitary picture or any video or anything else shows students, you know, quote-unquote, being gunned down by anybody. Now, there is one that I've found showing a few people there dead in China, but there's no evidence that it's actually from the massacre itself. Now, the BBC is a big culprit here. They were the first ones to produce this myth of a massacre without showing a single picture of a dead Chinese civilian. And again, this is all from Chua's book. I believed this narrative for a long time. I had some suspicions given who these protesters were. I remember there was one video, this must have been about 10 years ago or more. There were soldiers in the back of a truck. And you had students, you know, with their armbands and everything else yelling at them. And the soldiers were looking down like, you know, they were ashamed, doing nothing. And I mentioned some of this before. One of the worst, of course, is the tank man. We'll get to him in a minute. And I've mentioned him before. I want to continue to mock this ridiculous, this narrative. The tank man always bothered me. The minute something becomes this cultural icon, you know there's probably something wrong with it. The official story does not make sense as it stands. Even at the time, I'm watching the video feed, and I've seen 100 documentaries since then. The protesters, of course, as they never are, they are not the poor and the downtrodden. It's like in all of these, especially these Asian color revolutions, that the children of the elite at these dominant universities that the party itself created, this is the last group of people that the state wanted to massacre or condemn to long prison terms. The Chinese economy is based on foreign trade. It's based on, and of course, because of that, they're obsessed with promoting a positive image. Now, these days, it's almost because the left somehow demonized Vladimir Putin as a right-winger. I wonder where that came from. And so the idiot neocons need to counter that with demonizing another major power. Despite the fact that both American left and right nonsense condemn both powers, sometimes in completely opposite terms. So it's the whole thing is silly on numerous levels. China's public image is very important. To wantonly slaughter the children of the elite would be absurd. for a government that in 1989, in all other areas at that point, showed great foresight and conciliation. Now, the background to the student protests, and this is the case in a lot of places, we talked about Thailand, it's based on economic success, not failure. We talked about this in Korea. I have writings on this all over the place. This is 1989. This is the year where the USSR began its rapid collapse into history. Remember, at the time, the CIA was claiming, and I'm quoting directly, that the East German per capita output was equal to that of West Germany. As they were claiming that the two economies were equal, the greatest revolution in modern history was taking place. I remember, at the time, I remember my freshman year in college, which was 89-90, reading CIA reports about how well the Soviet Union was doing, and they're on their way to democracy and prosperity under the leadership of the Communist Party, which was very fashionable to like them at the time. And as they're writing this, the place is falling apart. They didn't come to admit their, well, they never admitted their error, they never do, until 92. China was determined to stay firm and not make the blatantly obvious errors that they saw occur in the Eastern Bloc. More damage was done to Russians in the 90s than in any other era. I mean, it's hard to match the 30s, but when you consider that the male lifespan was 58 or 59, we're talking about massive population loss and the complete destruction and liquidation of the economy, not to mention all the psychological elements that come from that. So, in distinction to that, the Chinese, of course, long abandoning any semblance of Maoism, you had this rising middle class, which, of course, you know, for better or for worse, comes with an immensely impressive economic growth that was just then beginning to show fruit and threaten the West. Now, usually what happens in these cases is that expectations rise much faster than the system can satisfy. Now, you did have a privately owned press in China, but they're usually nothing but trouble. They need to get readers and advertisers and promote an agenda. That's the only reason that a private newspaper exists. So they're usually far less reliable than the state papers in most places. So when it comes to artificially promoting expectations, it's the private press that was doing that, not the state press. And of course, American intelligence did have a hand in all of this because they were well aware that now China has a nationalist policy, not a communist one, that a massive first world Chinese empire would be a huge thorn in the side for American foreign policy. The U.S. simply can't do what it wants in Asia. Now, this is directly from the CIA writing in 1989. By 1989, it had become apparent that there were serious problems with China's ambitious economic reform package. Government corruption was rampant, and prices of consumer goods, which had been held fixed until 1984, were now skyrocketing out of control as the Chinese, many for the first time ever, were feeling the effects of inflation. So right there, of course, they admit that China is no longer a communist state. You can't be a communist state with any private capital, with any market relationships, and certainly not fixed prices. So China had long since abandoned all of this, which is a reason, and kind of replaced nationalism and Han, racial ideology and all that took its place, and this was the foundation of the economic explosion. Now, every year, and we've seen this in the Financial Times and the financial press worldwide, they predict China's collapse, I mean, at least every year. Now, the inflation, all that was wildly exaggerated. They're having trouble with the idea that this now national socialist state was doing extremely well, better than the U.S. And so they, through wish fulfillment, figured if they just keep saying this, it's going to happen. Inflation, corruption, all these things, of course, that the West, you know, deals with all the time, was going to bring down. Because even their success now must be a problem because inflation is going to result. Trying to always take away from the success of a non-oligarchic state. Every year since Tiananmen, you hear, and I'm hearing it now, China's going to collapse. Fox News is big in this. And of course, they're always wrong. But it is important to understand this obsession as this unfolds. The truth of the matter is that the Chinese economic miracle was just beginning. And it was really beginning to irritate the American oligarchy. Given the strong role of the state in this development, these guys couldn't necessarily dominate the currency and make state policy. American investment has to benefit the local population. So as the USSR and Eastern Europe were heading towards, you know, fourth world status, with a few exceptions like Belarus, China was doing so well that inflation became a threat because the economic growth was so substantial. So the protests that developed in 89 received their force in the diplomatic cover, not to mention the biased press coverage, due to China's rapidly growing economy. It was based on its success. China was becoming a threat using nationalist, not the globalist, models of development. This was the problem then and now. But because they still use the Communist Party term, those who don't know anything can say, well, they're a communist state. See the same thing in Donetsk and in eastern Ukraine. Because they use, or you see it in Belarus. They have the KGB, they still use the Red Star, therefore they're communists. And if you're an idiot, you're going to think that, because all you see is, you know, superficial slogans. That's all you're going to see. Of course, none of that is true. Even Solzhenitsyn said in his book, Under the Rubble, he says, in order to make this transition, Russia's going to have to maintain the iconography and slogans of Marxism. It can't just quickly abandon it. And that was a very good idea. They can't. That will create such confusion. And of course, the Chinese were aware of that. The Belarusians were aware of that. And it was part of the foundation of their success. Now, the protests, this is, you know, again, one of the first color revolutions. These were tightly monitored by the CIA. Now, one of the student leaders, and we've talked about where these leaders come from and who they are. There's a YouTube video. It's still out there. And this was translated by Chua in the 2014 book. He says, and this is where the title comes from, Chai Ling, one of the protesters, says, actually, our wish is to see blood. That is to frustrate our government to the extreme that they will eventually butcher their citizens. I believe only through a river of blood in the square will the nation then open their eyes and unite. But how could we tell our fellow students our intention? Now, that speech is still available on YouTube. That was not available at all in the Western world until fairly recently. You can get the translator. YouTube has its built-in translator. You can actually upload one if it doesn't work on that one. So you actually hear what this guy is saying. No one knew this at the time, of course. It's all in Chinese. But in the Chua book, he's translated the entire thing. Now, I'm going to read at length. And this, again, comes from the same book. This is what the BBC reported. And this is what started it all. This was started all the mythology and all the stories. And I'm going to quote it at length because you see some of the absurdities, the claims which don't make any sense, and the contradictions, and how this is just a morality play rather than a news story. Here's what the BBC, this is the first big report that they put out. The noise of gunfire rose all from the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road at Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots. Heading down the road was hazardous business, but hundreds of people cheered as buses were set alight and army trucks caught fire too. They yelled and shouted, and then as troop lorries were seen moving down the road, there was gunfire from those lorries. The troops had been firing indiscriminately, but still, there are thousands of people in the streets who will not move back. Now that first paragraph alone, I love how they say caught fire, using the passive voice, like they just caught fire for no reason. Shooting indiscriminately, for no reason. Okay. The bicycle ricks saw scooped up the injured. Others were shunted onto bikes and pedaled to the hospital. Many were carried away by frantic local residents. There was confusion and despair among those who could hardly credit that their own army was firing wildly at them. Many were bystanders, perhaps naive about the savagery of the situation. Indeed, it was hard at times to grasp that this army was launching into an unarmed civilian population as if charging into battle. From Tiananmen Square, the sound of gunfire sounded like a battle, but it was one-sided. A line of soldiers were strung out. Facing a huge crowd, the air was filled with shouts of, "Fascists, stop killing!" We were in the line facing the troops. They were about 250 yards away. Young people were singing the Internationale to a background of gunfire. After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd's still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government!" A huge volley of shots, just as I left the front line, caused panic. A young man in front of me fell dead. I fell over him. Two others were killed yards away. Two more people lay wounded on the ground near me. Ambulances screamed up to the troop line and were turned away. They couldn't get to the square. Two ambulance drivers were shot and injured. Earlier, we'd been driving at the back of the Forbidden City, the old part of Peking near the square. We'd picked up a woman with a bullet in her head and took her to the nearby children's hospital into a scene of mayhem. Casualties were arriving every few seconds on bikes and rickshaws, park benches carried in, all with gunshot wounds. Housewives, elderly residents, people shot while sitting in their homes. The operating theater was overflowing, many of the staff in tears. In 20 minutes, 40 seriously injured were brought for emergency surgery. Two were already dead. In the streets, many came up to us, shaking with anger and disbelief and fear. Many were terrified, saying that there should be retribution. There was not one voice in the streets that did not express despair and rage. "Tell the world," they said to us. And this contradictory, nonsensical work of fiction was believed and taken seriously as literature. And I'm saying this is one of the, you know, more modern or early examples of this kind of so-called journalism. The lies and the storytelling, the breathless, over-described situation. All of the morality, all the, shooting for no reason, people being shot in their homes, soldiers shooting for no reason, just shooting ambulance drivers. I mean, you know, a woman had a bullet in her head. Everyone's in tears. They go to the BBC journalist and say, "Please, please tell the world." I don't need to tell you that not a syllable that that idiot wrote was true or what happened. It was utter make-believe. But that doesn't mean it didn't have substantial historical significance. No one witnessed any events like that, although early on you had a few people claiming to be eyewitnesses. Now, just off the, just think of the few, when you read something like that, and what should you be thinking? How is it that a panicked crowd were setting buses and armored personnel carriers on fire while being shot at? The Chinese army lost about 100 armored vehicles, and they suffered dozens of casualties. They lost 10 men. How is this possible, given the narrative of peaceful, unarmed protesters? This guy said a kid was shot right next to him, and he tripped over his body. By the way, he didn't pick up a camera at all during this period of time. And of course, nothing ever happened to him. I'm not sure where this guy was, how he got out. I mean, the story is so blatantly absurd, and yet to this day is considered a benchmark, a tremendous example of activist journalism. Then he claimed, "The troops have been firing indiscriminately, but still, there are thousands of people on the streets who will not move back." A minute later, the BBC video says, "After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government." That was already in the quotation I mentioned. But does that make any sense? Now, the author of this, the main book, you don't really have to be a scholar of political science to rip this apart. How can a line of protesters do anything if they're coming under machine gun fire? But not only are they holding their ground, but they're uttering grievances. But with all this, and there were journalists everywhere, not a single picture of a soldier firing on protesters that no one at the time seemed to notice. This has been going on since at least April. The world's media was present, but when this happened, no one bothered to bring a camera. I mentioned the section about the shooting the ambulance drivers for no reason. A young man in front of me fell dead, he said, and he tripped over. Two ambulance drivers. I mean, you know, still with all of this, no one picked up a camera. Not a single picture or video of any of these incidents exists anywhere. And none were demanded. And why the hell would ambulance drivers be shot? For target practice? Of course. These stories are day-to-day fare. And all the color revolutions, whether it be Western China or Eastern Ukraine, on and on, the exact same kind of breathless, make-believe, over-emotional journalism can be found today. The worst part of it all is that very few people caught these lies until very recently. Now, Caleb Maupin, I'll talk about here in a minute. Caleb, he wrote his book in 2016. He said this: regardless of how many times the Tiananmen narrative is refuted, Western media continues to repeat it. The words of Nicholas Kristof, James Miles, the Chinese government, and the eyewitness accounts of Chilean diplomats are merely ignored. An event that was far more complex, involving lots of confusion and violence on both sides, has been retold to Western audiences as some kind of classical tragedy, and the reality of what occurred is not even acknowledged. What Maupin says here is important. Told as a classical tragedy, meaning it is a work of fiction, the concern was to demonize the Chinese rise to prominence, the nationalist move in the Communist Party, and the fact that China is now getting in the way of American capitalism and not allowing them to take over the currency and the banking and everything else. In 2011, an article came out from Malcolm Moore, writing for the Telegraph in the UK. And the article was titled, "WikiLeaks, No Bloodshed Inside Tiananmen Square, Cable's Claim." All right, now here's what he says about this. The army came up against an elaborate system of blockades, described in a cable from May 21, 1989, which allowed students to control much of central Beijing. Inside the square itself, a Chilean diplomat watched the military enter the square and did not observe any mass firing of weapons into the crowds, though sporadic gunfire was heard. He said that most of the troops which entered into the square were actually armed only with anti-riot gear, truncheons and wooden clubs. They were backed up by armed soldiers. These are the protests, including Liu Xiaobo, urged the students to depart the square, and the students left the square through the southeast corner. The Telegraph then pointed out the confession made by BBC journalist James Miles, who said, and he's one of the people who wrote some of these breathless articles before, he said he might have given the wrong impression. There was no massacre in Tiananmen Square that day. And this was in 2009. Now, Miles does believe the government killed unarmed protesters, but just not the way the media had reported. It remains very doubtful that he witnessed any of these events, because he claimed, and this is a claim that was made many times, that he was watching from the Peking Hotel. The problem is, the Peking Hotel is not near the square, and you can't see the square from there. Richard Roth of CBS News finally said there was no Tiananmen Square massacre. Richard Roth, again, CBS News, this is what he writes. "We saw no bodies, injured people, ambulances, or medical personnel. In short, nothing to even suggest, let alone prove, that a massacre had recently occurred in that place. What they did see? Several dead soldiers and a captured tank crew, at least several captured tank crews. And this comes also from a declassified U.S. embassy document from 1989. They note, not just Roth, several others, they note that a picture was published at the time, I don't remember this, but I've seen it since then, showing two mutilated bodies, and it was, of course, described as murdered protesters. You see this in a newspaper, and of course, you know, you assume, unfortunately, they were two dead soldiers. They were published in 1989, front page, as victims of the Army's brutality. Now, Caleb Maupin's article, I'm going to quote from it some more here. He says, other estimates of how many Chinese soldiers died range between 12 and 200. After the square was peacefully cleared, when armed battles took place across Beijing, the Washington Post described an organized group of 100 to 150 people, armed with chains, Molotov cocktails, and clubs, carefully organized into squads of five. Cars and public buses were torched and gunfire was exchanged between the military and other forces. Almost all the pictures I remember at the time and I've seen since then show unarmed soldiers. Gregory Clark, who was vice president of the Akita International University and the former China desk officer for Australia's Foreign Service, he wrote an article for the Japan Times. This is July 21st, 2008. It's called Birth of a Massacre Myth. And he supports everything that we've been saying so far. The Spanish ambassador to Peking, Eugenio Bregolot, says clearly there was no massacre and only a handful were killed on both sides at the worst of the confrontation that day. Bregolot says most of the reports of an alleged massacre were made by journalists hunkered down in the safe haven of the Beijing Hotel, at the Peking Hotel, some distance from the square. As I said, you can't see the square from the Peking or Beijing Hotel. That's where they all were, and they were making up this story and then claiming that they could see it from the hotel. Well, you kind of have to be there to know that you can't see the square from the hotel. So how would we know? This is Johnson's Law. We weren't there. These guys realized, again, this is before the web, they can make up whatever they want. They could just say, well, we're there. You weren't there. What are you talking about? We were there. We saw all this. We were right in the thick of it. Bullets whizzing by our ears, like the first idiot said. How would you know any better in 1989? Graham Earnshaw, who was a correspondent for Reuters, who spent the night at the alleged site of this massacre, and he stated that he witnessed no killing of protesters by the PLA. But even then, even at the time, you had journalist after journalist saying that few were killed, that there was no massacre, but no one seemed to care or notice. That BBC stupidity, once that came out, it was done in such this, emotional, breathless kind of a way that the weak-minded got all teary-eyed. How could they do this? And liberals and conservatives alike were condemning China, wanting to declare war, all this stuff. The Independent, the UK Independent, wrote in 2011, a wealth of eyewitness testimony and interviews suggests that one stubbornly popular picture of what happened in Tiananmen Square needs revision. There was no massacre of students on the square. Standard histories, such as by Yale's Jonathan Spence, as well as by the recent groundbreaking Tiananmen papers, suggest that Chinese soldiers did not fire on students before they left the square in the early hours of June 4, 1989. As I've said, many of the BBC claim that they were witnessing all of this from the Peking Hilton. And again, as I've said, no one bothered to notice that you can't see the square from there. There's no view from that Hilton hotel that you can see the square from. And what communist country has a Hilton in it? They were given a narrative, and they were forced to comply. I remember very well. Coming into that fall of 89, I had professors saying that tens of thousands, this number keeps growing. Like all these make-believe stories, the number keeps growing. This was before the web. I wasn't there. I suppose it's true. Without any evidence, eyewitness testimony, video or pictures, the world, the academics, the journalists believed that thousands of unarmed protesters demanding abstract democracy were gunned down by the army for no obvious reason. None of it is true. No one has questioned this. Human Rights Watch, who is, as you know, a leftist corporate institution financed by corporate America, and one of the least reliable sources for current events, interviewed 14 sources for the massacre, and not a single one was an eyewitness. The Spanish media had a cameraman, A. Rodriguez, filming throughout the night, and all of his footage shows absolutely nothing. Now, I think I've mentioned Tank Man before, and, you know, the whole story bothered me. And it bothered me that no one questioned it. We know the story, right? There's this one Chinese guy standing in front of this column of tanks. He's not letting them pass. And the tank driver is doing all in his power to go around him, and he's not letting that happen. But because they're more concerned with the emotional impact of these things, no one asks any questions. It's the emotional impact. It's sensationalism. It's getting people glued to their TV that matters, not the truth of the matter. That's not what a journalist does. That's what I do. That's what people like me are supposed to do. Journalists are not to do. If journalists had that role, they'd be political scientists or economists. They're not. Journalists have a very different job. It's to find the angle, to find the human interest, not the truth of the matter. First of all, the tanks were leaving the square. Even the initial descriptions of the that picture say that this was after the massacre occurred. Then, of course, the question that I remember asking in the 90s, why didn't they just roll over the guy? If they had just massacred innocent people, why were they going through such trouble to avoid him? And it's made even more absurd that there are those who claimed that this is from the 1st Armored Division, by the way. They did run over protesters just shortly before this incident. That's in the lead book from 2011. The same BBC people that made up this ridiculous narrative around this very brief video were also saying that this very same tank unit was running over people for no reason in Tiananmen Square, but not him. Why not? Did they know they were being filmed? They couldn't possibly have known that, and so what? There were thousands of journalists at this thing, with cameras everywhere. Well, what would they care now for? But it fit the narrative so perfectly, and people are stupid. Academics and journalists and you know, people sitting home watching this on TV, tearing up because of this icon of liberal resistance. Resistance against fascism. You see it everywhere. It's been on album covers. And it is absolute nonsense. It's actual proof that it didn't happen. They'll just run the guy. And why was he so certain that they weren't going to run him over? He had to have known that that's not why they were there. And if this actually happened, the way the regime says, he would have known that these tanks were just running. What would be the point of just getting crushed? It is so absurd, and that not one person, at least that I know of at the time, questioned this. How does no one question a stupid, you know, and can you imagine, there's very few more political images, more in the popular culture than that one. Now, I've made the same argument about the Kent State nonsense. Not a single video or picture of soldiers killing those kids. There were journalists everywhere. It doesn't exist. I have gone over those pictures with a fine-tooth comb, and none of them make any sense. I don't know if you know this, but every one of those M16s were destroyed right after the so-called massacre there. There was no explanation for why this was happening, why they would do this. And one of the marks of a bad made-up story is that they don't give a reason for it. There's protests in the streets all over the place like this. You don't massacre people and run people over with tanks for it. Now, certainly a country that was doing extremely well and whose economy is based on foreign trade, which means its image in the public is absolutely critical. There was one of these many student leaders. Oh, they all speak English, by the way. They all do. Wiracocci is his name. I don't know how the Chinese works. It's Wuerkaixi. Whatever the heck that is. He claimed 2,000 were killed. And he claimed to have seen two rows of students murdered. Though, it turns out, it was later shown he left the square about 4 a.m., long before the killings, alleged killings, took place. A Hong Kong student was quoted as saying 1,000 were murdered, but then later he admits under questioning he actually saw zero. That's from the Matthews book from 1998. There was no massacre. And the problem is, of course, before the internet, it's really, now, of course, we can look this stuff up. But even at the time, it's embarrassing that so many of the internal problems with the story weren't torn to pieces. This is supposed to be what a scholar does, and no one did it. As this is going on, spring or early summer of 89, the Chinese government was concerned with two things. Continued economic growth, and their public image abroad. When these protests first started, Deng Xiaoping and others wanted to handle this with great delicacy and tact. So many elites had kids there. Early on, Deng Xiaoping met with hunger strikers. He met with them. He met with some of these leaders. And he gave many conciliatory speeches to demonstrators. Martial law was opposed by many of the retired generals of the PLA. It was considered a political gamble and very, very risky. And the main fear wasn't so much the protesters, but insubordination in the army itself. Again, these were the children of the elite. You had party officials and economic leaders and bankers who had kids there. You don't just go and start shooting them. Now, once martial law was declared, these so-called students, and we don't know how many of them were students, they just assume they are, they began to set up roadblocks, booby traps all over the place, and every possible manner of blockade to stop the, or slow the army's route to the square. So by the end of May, units from the 39th, 24th, and 27th Division, among many others, had been mobilized against the protesters. And the minute they got there, they were surrounded by these protesters in huge numbers the minute they reached the capital. There was no fear on either side. The soldiers were unarmed. Helicopters dropped leaflets warning the protesters to disband and promised all kinds of conciliatory action, which, as Deng Xiaoping had already shown, wasn't just mere rhetoric. Units from the 65th Army were forced back due to student blockades. Therefore, it didn't take a genius to realize the Army was under strict orders not to use force. You had entire regiments forced back because of these blockades and booby traps. You already had Army casualties by this point. Now, the riot police, not the Army, were used to force demonstrators off the bridges and key roadways. So really, the only purpose of the army was to demonstrate the party's resolve and not as a real threat. They were meant to back up the comps, not to substitute for them. But it didn't take long. One soldier had been pinned under a bridge for several days without food or water. Many had been captured. You see this in South Korean riots, too. They capture some of these guys. Whole tank crews have been captured. And both police and army units were becoming concerned here. What ended up happening is the troops were moved into the city via underground tunnels to avoid any bloodshed. It took hours of standoffs, police injuries, and attacks on army convoys before finally they used tear gas. That's from the Wiltshire book from 2005. Any protester killed was begging for it, and many were armed and extremely violent. One method they used was to ram metal rods in the wheels of the APCs. Tanks weren't moving very quickly, so they had all these methods of jamming the treads. Well, it only bought them a second or two, of course. So after they did that, they'd put a blanket soaked with gasoline on top of the thing and they'd set it alight. Then crews would be forced out of it, of the vehicle, but then they became POWs. So you had all of these, you know, creative guerrilla tactics used, and the Chinese army losses were not negligible. What happened to these POWs, I simply don't know, but they were captured in fairly large numbers, especially when they were driven out of APCs and tanks. They were ordered not to use any kind of force. Overall, the deaths were very few, and none of it was witnessed by Western journalists, or at least none possessing a camera. At the time, and I do distinctly remember this, the number was tens of thousands had been mowed down by PLA forces. The New York Times, you know, pretending to be this, you know, authoritative journal, claimed that 2,600 students were killed. They were citing a liberal organization. They did say that the number might be high. On the other hand, the very same author from the New York Times says that hundreds and even possibly more military trucks and APCs have been destroyed by the demonstrators. I don't think you guys know how difficult it is to destroy an APC or any of the armored vehicles that an army would use. You have to know what you're doing. And certainly, the driver, the crews of these vehicles were told not to do anything about it. This was a very early version of this postmodern color revolution. It was make-believe. I'm hearing the Fox News crowd talk about this massacre now all the time, as if they know something. I've been rolling my eyes so much I'm getting a headache. The press, as always, is completely and totally unreliable. That BBC, that long BBC passage that I read, had so many red flags in it. This self-romanticization. Oh, how brave I am. Kids are getting shot all around me, but somehow I'm unscathed. That they were holding their ground despite being machine gunned. And they were articulate enough to articulate grievances. He didn't speak Chinese, by the way. Somehow, though, they all learned English just quickly enough to tell him that they were fascists and they needed to stop killing us for no reason. My favorite is the one with a bullet in her head. And they got to the hospital somehow. They got through the line, military. I don't know what they were driving, what they were doing. You know, 1 minute he's in a car, 1 minute he's walking. And everyone was in tears in the hospital, like they'd never seen bullet wounds before. You see this with all the stories of these school shootings. The cops who've been, you know, working crime scenes for 30 years start crying. Again, a giant red flag. This is one of the first of these color revolution stories. And ever since then, you have the exact same narrative. They just fill in the blank. They put a different country. All these student leaders are always students. No one asked the government anything. No one asked the army anything. No one asked the embassy anything. And any dissenting voice is not just condemned, but sometimes physically attacked, jobs are lost, and their entire legitimacy brought into disrepute. It's far worse now than it was then. I don't remember the Chilean embassy who actually did, they're the only embassy that actually had a view of the square, were completely ignored, and they were screaming that nothing happened here. And of course, Pinochet was running Chile at the time. They certainly weren't going to defend the Chinese, no matter what was happening in the party at the time. And everyone ignored them. But this is what happens. This is kind of how the mass mind operates. They see this exciting morality play, white hat, black hat, everything simplified down to an action movie, which is all they really know. And any details, any argument, any complexity is rejected. Their minds often simply can't handle complexity. Complexity is too difficult for them. So what else from that era do we take for granted? Stuff that never happened. At the time I wrote this article, I wrote, "The internet makes suppressing information very difficult without mass censorship." This was a few years ago. They realized what the internet can do. Of course, in my final line in this was, whether anyone listens to those who know the truth is a separate matter. The credibility of the media is dying a very slow death. You could still quote the New York Times and have it be considered some authority. And we know that they're nothing of the kind. It is a fourth-rate, Soviet-era Pravda. These aren't smart people. These are mindless conformists who have no idea how to cite sources or put together a rational argument. They simply don't care. They're self-righteous, disproportionately Jewish. They live in groupthink and mass conformity and congratulate themselves that because they make a lot of money, they're therefore classy and intelligent and motivated. Do not overestimate their ability. When you don't have a lot of people saying no to you, it's very easy to get soft and lazy. When I was in grad school, I said the same thing. These professors have never heard. They've never heard a conservative point of view, let alone the nationalist point of view. Probably in their entire professional lives. Certainly not competently. Everything they think they know is really their own inventions, their caricatures that they have created in their heads. So when I came around, I was a problem. The only thing that saved me is that I was a nice guy. I showed respect. I became their friend before they knew what else I was doing. So by the time I said anything, well, he might be nuts, but he's a nice guy. Today, I don't know, but that's pretty much how I did it. You show them respect. You disagree. You need to show them never be disagreeable. I developed an entire personality, which I still have today, of being the only guy knew the truth about all this stuff with these highly educated but very arrogant and very sheltered professors and grad students. It took a while. You have to earn their trust and then slowly start asking all the right questions. Especially if they've had a few beers, you'd be surprised what you can do. The media is not there to tell you the truth. They have no obligation to educate you. They have no obligation to tell you the truth on anything. Their job is to salvage the viewership that's been dying for a decade of the mass media, to get people into a human interest story, not the truth. Anyway, I think I made my point. Please stop watching Fox News. Stop listening to conservatives. They are your enemy. And they're going to get the U.S. into a war, which it will lose very quickly with the Chinese, over this kind of mythology and make-believe based on no knowledge and a lot of emotion. You stand your ground. You speak the truth. Don't get angry at them. You stand your ground. You keep cool. And you simply state facts and let them scream and yell. They're worthless. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.